We don't believe that any human being should have to live through this winter here in New York in any tents.
New York is building tent cities to house migrants. It's Tuesday, October 11th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Thousands of migrants from Latin America have come to New York recently, some sent north by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. Mayor Eric Adams declared a state of emergency in the hopes of getting some federal help housing them. But for now, New York is sending people to a tent city on Randall's Island in the East River, just off Manhattan. Advocates are calling on Adams to find a better solution before winter sets in. Felipe de la Hoz writes the newsletter Borderlines, and he spoke earlier with Deepa Fernandez.
Well, you know, they are claiming that it's going to be, you know, more structurally sound, that there's not, you know, as much of a flood-prone area, though a lot of folks have doubts about that, as Randall Island has, of course, had its own flooding historically. You know, I think they're just sort of looking for any solution that will allow them to kind of take some pressure off the city's existing shelter systems and the hotel backfills.
I mean, it's also an island that's not easy to get onto or off of. It almost feels like they're being kind of shafted away.
Yeah, and I think actually that's a good point. A lot of people fear that it'll be a situation, obviously very, very, different, but that there will be a kind of taste of Rikers Island, which is a bit of kind of out of sight, out of mind, and that...
Which is the infamous prison in New York.
Right.
You know, there's also been a lot of criticism, as you're talking about, his state senator, Jessica Ramos, speaking recently on New York One. Let's listen.
We don't believe that any human being should have to live through this winter here in New York, especially if they haven't done so before, in any tents. There are alternatives, whether it be at hotels or whether it be converting other spaces, whether it's offices, stadiums, into emergency housing.
I mean, that's real, Felipe. The New York winter is no joke. I don't think anybody would want to be in a tent during winter in New York City.
No, definitely not. And I think the administration has said that it's not mandated, but they will attempt to have everyone in these tents for no longer than 96 hours as kind of a staging area. But it's not clear where they're going to go afterwards, right? The city's using dozens of hotels that are trying to. The shelters are overflowing. I think a lot of folks are hoping that there will be something more like a regional response, you know, that incorporates the federal and the state governments as well, instead of kind of landing all on New York City.
So where are migrants kind of landing right now? Is there any use of hotels, or I've heard discussion also of cruise ships?
Yeah, the administration has said they're in conversations with, I think, three cruise ship operators about maybe having some cruise ships house folks. There are hotels in use and the city's standard shelters. And so I think, you know, one thing to understand is the city is under a decades-old consent decree that mandates that anyone that requires shelter must be provided shelter. So it's a right to shelter jurisdiction. And so legally, the city can't turn anyone away, which is why it's turning to these sorts of very drastic and kind of unprecedented solutions.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, New York City is the only city in the country that has this right to shelter. But I'm wondering, does a tent bed count as shelter?
No, and actually that's been part of the controversy, because the decree actually sets out very specific standards of safety and kind of habitability, and folks feel that, you know, they don't count. For example, there must be mattresses, they must be spaced a certain amount apart, and the shelters, I mean, the tents would probably not fulfill this criteria. So there's, you know, some controversy about whether they're even technically legal under the consent decree.
And some construction noise, typical New York City construction noise, I think, happening there behind you, Felipe.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No
sorry
problem. But Mayor Adams is talking about reassessing this right to shelter. How are the people in New York City reacting to that?
I think there are kind of two ways that people are approaching it. I think, you know, some folks do understand that it doesn't necessarily make sense, you know, to treat this as a problem in the exact same way as the homelessness issue that we have in the city, right? That there are kind of, this is an extraordinary situation. These folks are largely being bused here with almost no coordination from the state government of Texas. And there are, you know, clear impacts on the ability to provide shelter services for everyone else that needs them in the city. But I think, you know, advocates are very worried that it's opening a can of worms to attempt to relitigate this, consent decree in a way that, you know, might lead the city down a path of kind of getting out of providing these shelter services to everyone, not just the migrants.
Well, thank you. We'll continue to watch what's happening there in New York City. Felipe de la Hoz is a contributing member of the New York Daily News editorial board and co-founder of Border Lines. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, actor Wendell Pierce stars in a new production of Death of a Salesman. Robin Young saw the show on Broadway and talked to the former star of The Wire about how casting black actors to play the Lohman family gives the classic play new meaning. That's after the break.
When Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman hit Broadway in 1949, it won Tony Awards and a Pulitzer Prize and brought grown men to their knees. It told the story of Willie Lohman, whose sense of self centered on his success as a salesman in the 1930s, and when his sales slip and he falls in his son Biff's eyes after Biff witnesses an indiscretion, Willie loses his grip. And in a new production just opened on Broadway, Willie Lohman, his two sons, and steadfast wife Linda are all black actors. Willie is played by Wendell Pierce, star of the gripping TV shows The Wire and Tremé. In this scene, he asks his young boss Howard, played by the white actor Blake DeLong, for weekly pay instead of a commission.
That's just the thing.
If I have $40, that's all I need, Howard.
Kid,
$40.
I can't take blood from a stone.
Howard, in the year Al Smith was nominated, your father came to
me. I've got
to
see some people,
I'm talking about your father! There were promises made across this desk. You mustn't tell me. You have people to see. I put 34 years into this firm, Howard, and now I can't pay my insurance. You can't eat the orange and throw the peel away. A man is not a piece of fruit.
Not a piece of fruit. Pierce told us this role isn't validating for black actors. They're all over Broadway this year. But it's different, something he's still learning. For this white audience member, when Willie, in a moment of dementia, looks up where he built a swing for his boys, his words, throw up a rope, hang it high, made me gasp. Did you also feel it, throwing up the rope?
Take the rope, sling it around, climb up and take it down. I never thought about that. But the idea of a black man then talking about slinging up a rope on a tree, just that phrase conjures up lynching. That's how prevalent it was in this country.
We sat down with Wendell Pierce in New York recently. What had you seen? Every actor studies those privileged to get to play this role. Who had you seen? What did you think of Willie Lohman?
I have seen Lee J. Cobb, the original actor who played the role on Broadway. I saw Brian Dennehy, I saw Philip Seymour Hoffman, I saw the television version of Dustin Hoffman.
And when you were watching, did you think it was possibly a role for you?
I had never considered playing the role. Part of it was just the insecurity of a journeyman actor who I considered myself. And a part of it is something that I share with the character Willie himself. Linda says it, even a small man gets tired like a great man. I feel like I'm a little boat looking for a harbor in my own career. So that was the epiphany for me.
Okay, let's just take a second there. Willie Lohman, he's at a point in his life where he feels he hasn't achieved a greatness. You're saying you identified with that. You're aware you're Wendell Pierce, right? From The Wire. Everyone we spoke to had come to see you.
Yes, I'm aware that I am Wendell Pierce. But when you're playing a role like this, especially at my age, there's a reflection, a self-reflection that comes with the work. And I had to consider, are my best days behind me? What have I created when it comes to family and friends and the wealth of spirit? So this was a great challenge and a great gift because it gave me time to sit and reflect and really delve deep into those same considerations that Willie Lohman is thinking about, but also learn from the play, because it's a cautionary tale. I didn't want to make the same mistakes Willie makes.
Let's talk about the debate at one time about whether or not there should be not just black Willie Lohman, but the black Lohman family. You know August Wilson, iconic black playwright, was dead set against it. I'm going to read here. This is to the idea of there being a black Willie Lohman. It would be an assault on our, meaning black Americans, presence and our different but honorable history in America. And critics at the time agreed. John Lehrer said to replace a Jewish Willie Loman with an African-American would change something elemental in the play.
To do this as a colorblind Death of a Salesman would be an insult. We're not colorblind in our production. We're color-specific. It says something when I am with, have an infidelity with a white woman in 1932. It says so much about the pressure he's under that he would risk his life, which is what he does when he has that infidelity, just to get an opportunity to sell his products in that store. That's interpretation. That's to elevate and amplify the play. I am, as any actor, as any artist, coming to do Death of a Salesman. And there was never a debate as whether or not Lee J. Cobb should do it because he was a big man who Arthur Miller didn't want. He wanted a small person. He wrote a shrimp. But he saw Lee J. Cobb, and they said, I loved his talent, and cast him.
Arthur Miller is said to have written this about his uncle, who was a salesman, who was Jewish, and some of the things that happened in Miller's home, these relationships that he writes about.
And that is not unique to a Jewish family.
Right.
There's going to be men who come to this play. There was a black man who stopped me on the street last night and said, thank you, you told my story.
Yes.
I'm Biff. He literally said that to me. He said, I'm Biff. And I said, if you still have your father, call him. There's so many people that come to the play who have never read the play.
Well, and we need to say, race is never mentioned once in the play. These are the exact words of Arthur Miller. But as you just alluded to, the scene with the mistress, you've said you can feel it on the stage, where things that are Arthur Miller's words become different because you are a black family. They take on a different meaning. Can you speak of some of those moments?
The one that comes to mind the most is when the woman is standing there and says, I hope no one sees me in the hall.
This is the white woman mistress.
The white woman saying to two black men, as she is underdressed, a year after the Scottsboro boys' trial, I hope no one sees me like this in the hall. And that is a unveiled threat. Mr. Loman, you feel a lot more comfortable back here.
The waiter in the restaurant gives him the table in the back.
Yes, the microaggression, the expectation of Howard that I pick up something that falls off his desk.
Howard is the scion of the company that you your character works for. Mm-hmm. His father had helped you along, but now this snotty little kid, mm-hmm. sorry. And yeah, when he yells at your character, what happens to you?
It's degrading, it's humiliating, it's infuriating, it's enraging. It propels me. It is moments like that are just amplified, knowing that I can't do anything. I think of, in that moment, how, at that time, you weren't supposed to look a white man in the eye.
You don't. Yeah. You shift your head.
Yes. I'm trying to avoid getting fired, desperately doing everything, and not to rock the boat, not to infuriate him, even though he is humiliating me. We have to remember this is a time where you have to step off the curb for a white person to pass.
Do you feel also amplified, that's a great word
yes.
for what this does, the notion that Willie Loman cannot accept that he did have success? In your Willie Loman, here's a black man in the 30s, play came out in 49, who owned a home, had a job in a, what we're presuming is a white company, as the face of the company on the road. Mm-hmm. By any stretch, there's some success there, but he couldn't see it.
Which is the hubris of the play. Willie Loman, a man in pursuit of this materialism, cannot see that he is a wealthy man, a wealth of love, a wealth of family. And he couldn't see that because he was prescribing another barometer by which to judge himself. And that's the lesson, that if he could only take the blinders off and see how wealthy he actually was.
You have to hope that today a Willie Loman would do what it is that he loved more than anything, which was build and use his hands, and so would his sons, and they'd have a successful career building homes, you know, and, right. and but he can't make that decision.
But also, at the same time, you have to be realistic about there are those who do not have his best interest at heart, and that there will be placed in front of him monumental obstacles to make sure that he is not successful.
Andre DeShields of Hadestown and Another Planet, you know, plays your deceased brother. And then we have Sharon D. Clarke, the British actress, Linda Lohman, stunning.
I don't say he's a great man. Winnie Lohman never made a lot of money. His name was never in the paper. He's not the finest character that ever lived. But he's a human being. And a terrible thing is happening to him. So attention must be paid. He's not to be allowed to fall into his grave like an old dog. Attention. Attention must be finally paid to such a person.
Does she make you cry?
Absolutely. Sharon D. Clarke is a rock. I say it at the beginning of the play. She is my foundation and my support on and off stage from the very beginning. And she is emblematic of so many women who have held together families, generations, in spite of all the violent obstacles placed in the lives of black folks. I cannot imagine doing this role without her.
Yeah. Wendell Pierce, you are now a Willie Loman. I mean, you listed them. There's only a few on these great stages, and you are one.
This is not only a high water mark in my career, but is one of the highlights of my life. I take this with me to my dying day. And in the words of Arthur Miller, there's a certain immortality in the theater, not given by books or monuments, but the knowledge an actor takes with him to his dying day that on a certain afternoon in a dusty theater, he cast a shadow of a person that was not himself and uttered an unsung heart song that the common man feels but never utters, he gave voice to. And with that, he joins the ages.
Death of a Salesman star, Wendell Pierce. For more, go to hereandnow.org.
Coming up, women are often seen as either too young or too old in our culture. Deepa talks to two women separated by 3.5 decades who are trying to fight that stereotype. Stick around.
It's no secret that in 2022, women still face sexism. But as they get older, they also face discrimination based on their age. This is called gendered ageism. It impacts a woman's professional growth, her physical health, and her emotional well-being. Aging experts say one solution is to support women as they age and reframe how our culture thinks about getting older, is to have more intergenerational conversations. So we'll start right here. Joining us now is Jeanette Liardi, a gerontologist who writes for a blog called Ageful Living. She's in Portland, Oregon, and she's 70. Jeanette, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Deepa, for allowing me to be on the program.
Welcome. And also with us is Christina Peoples, a gerontologist who runs the blog Gero What? She's in Greensboro, North Carolina. She's 34. Christina, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Lots to talk about, but Jeanette, let's start with you. This combination of ageism and sexism is something you've personally experienced. Can you start by telling us how this has happened to you?
It's happened to me in several ways. The interesting thing is that ageism actually goes both ways. So young women can experience ageism in a different way than older women can. So I experienced ageism when I was young, in my 20s, when people considered me too young to understand certain things. But then as I've gotten older, then the other end of ageism kicks in. So for example, if I'm at a supermarket where a cashier who's much younger than me will say, "Did you find everything you need, young lady?" And I'll say, and I have gray hair. I have obviously gray hair. So I'll say to that person, do you have any eye problems? I'm actually an old person and I'm okay with that. And you know what? You can be okay with that too. So it's a two-edged sword and it's what I call aging while female. And we endure that all throughout our lives.
You know, and I'm guessing that this has all inspired you to get involved in work in this field. Tell us a little bit about what your work in this space entails.
Well, I speak and write about ageism in all aspects. I'm a social gerontologist, so my interest when it comes to ageism is in the social aspects of how ageism affects our lives when people talk down to someone like me because they assume I can't hear well or that I don't understand things, or they act overly sweet to me, calling me honey and sweetie. Those are demeaning ways of looking at older adults. And the ironic thing is that as we age, we become more different from one another. So people should never be making assumptions about a person based on what group they seem to belong to, but it is especially more frequent as we age.
I want to bring Christina into the conversation. You're taking on a lot of the stereotypes and discriminatory behaviors, really, even just in as simple as everyday language, that older people might experience, yet being in a younger demographic, you yourself haven't experienced that. But talk about how you've seen the intersection of gendered ageism play out.
A lot of times, there's a lot of responsibilities that are placed on women, older and younger. For an older woman, there's the responsibility of being a nurturer, a caregiver, and all of these roles, right? For a younger woman, there's this expectation that we should be wanting to have children. We should be wanting to be married. We should have all of these goals that are centered with us nurturing and caring for people. And so as you continue aging, you have all of these expectations of you. And then that has an effect on our health, how well we live, our finances, our roles at work, our roles in our families.
You know, I think what's also really interesting to me, Christina, about your work as a gerontologist, you're a Black woman, and I'm wondering if you see other women of color in your field doing this work.
No. There's a handful, and that is something that I'm looking forward to seeing grow. I know we exist, but we don't see a lot of women of color being highlighted in the field of aging. And we need those voices because when it comes to being able to relate to someone in order to receive information, encouragement at times, all of those things, it helps when there's a person that you can relate to. And oftentimes that first point of recognition or first point that really draws you in is like, oh, this is a person of color. Somewhere in there, they will kind of get me. They may have experienced something similar to me. There's all of these things that make it relatable and an individual more open to being able to receive what's being put out.
You know, and just to bring Jeanette back into the conversation, I know one of the key things, Jeanette, that you have said is, and you do, is have interactions and relationships with younger people and encourage younger people to do the same with older people. Why is that fruitful? What do you get out of that?
Well, here's the thing. Ageism can start being implanted into a person's brain as early as 3 years old. That's how early children can start to absorb negative feelings about aging, about getting older.
You know, I read something that was written about how, like, for the 100th day of school,
yes,
many schools mark it by having you dress as a person who's 100 years old, aka grandma. And I had that moment of like, oh, my children did that. And I didn't even think to object to that.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. And so what some schools are doing now, and this is something that we gerontologists are actively working to discourage in schools, do not do this dress as a 100-year-old person. Instead, some schools are doing activities like put a penny in a jar every day. And at the end of 100 days, look at what 100 pennies look like, so that it really reflects aging as a cumulative process. And we have so much ageism in our society because we tend to see aging as nothing but deterioration and decline. What people do not understand, don't know about, and this is what I'd love to teach about, are the changes in the older adult brain. Yes, we lose certain capacities of short-term memory and speed of processing, how fast we can react to certain things, but we actually gain other skills that we couldn't possibly get when we were younger. So, for example, both sides of our brain are connected by a tissue called the corpus callosum, bridge of tissue. And that gets its thickest, its most mature when we're in our 50s. And what that means is that as we get older, we tend to use both sides of our brain simultaneously better and more often. It's not to say that young people don't use both sides of their brain. Of course they do. But we get better and better at using both sides simultaneously. And what that means is that older adults, we tend to see the grayness of issues. Things are not as clearly one way or the other. We tend to see the what-ifs and have you thought about this happening? So younger brains have their skills, have their advantages, and so do older brains. And that's why it's important for young and old people to interact constantly.
And just to your point of conversation intergenerationally is really important. I'd love to end by asking, you know, if either of you have questions for each other.
I think I'd like to ask Christina, how does she see herself changing as a gerontologist as she gets older? What experiences is she looking forward to, given who she is and what she does now?
Oh, that's a good one. For me, I see myself holding this title as a gerontologist with confidence. I have the confidence, but there's so much more room for it to grow. And just continuing to connect with people of all ages. I have friends in their 70s, in their 60s, in their 50s. I want that to continue. And just bringing to light how we are all aging. And there are ways that we can do this the way we want to do it.
And Christina, I bet you have a million questions you'd love to ask Jeanette, but could you narrow it down to just one?
Okay, how have you been able to navigate through this intersection of being a woman and being older? What are some tips that you would give anybody as they continue aging and navigating through all of the intersections that come about?
I would say the first thing we all need to do, no matter how old we are, but especially as we get older, is to really investigate in our own minds what we think about getting older. If we ourselves believe that getting older is a bad thing, then that's going to affect the way we see the world and interact with other people. Like, I don't want to go to this party. I may be the only old person there, kind of thing. So first of all, we need to just get it straight in our brains what we think about aging and to develop a positive attitude about it. And then the other thing is to advocate for ourselves, to be brave. When a situation comes up, we can gently correct someone else if we feel that we are being put down as an older person. So those would be the two things I would suggest.
You know, I love this point maybe to end on for all of us to do some self-reflection. You know, they say we should think about our close friends circle. How diverse is it? Do we have people of different races and ethnicity as our very close people who we'd go to in a jam when we want to cry on their shoulder? And I think what you've both made me think about is, do we have people of different age groups in our very close circle? I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Jeanette Liardi is a gerontologist who writes for a blog called Ageful Living. And Christina Peoples is a gerontologist who runs the blog Gero What? Jeanette and Christina, thank you both for taking the time today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. You can find a lot more from our radio show at hereandnow.org, including a look at one rural county in Nevada that's going to hand count ballots because of conspiracy theories about voting machines. And it's been nearly a month since Mahsa Amini died in the custody of Iran's morality police. Security forces have killed dozens more since in their crackdown on nationwide protests, but the demonstrations show no sign of slowing down.
I'm very surprised by the courage, by the level of courage and bravery that these protesters are showing women, young girls, and allies that have essentially risked their lives staying on the streets for 4 weeks.
Today's stories were produced by Jill Ryan, Emiko Tamagawa, and Ashley Locke. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike and Max, along with me, Chris Bentley. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.